honey, be bee for the bee for the honey, be bee for the
KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM and KSQT Prunedale 89.7 online at ksqd.org. And I'm Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective. And today I'm here with my friend Doriad Locks, friend and teacher Doriad Locks. And I feel obligated to say that she has several poetry collections, including Even As the Day is Long, which was finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and The Book of Men, which is the winner of the Patterson Poetry Prize. But we're going to be talking about this lovely slim volume of poems called Life on Earth, which isn't out quite yet. But it's
it came out the 9th.
Oh, it came out the 9th. And
so it is available at your local bookstore or your indie bookstore.
Everywhere you get your books, but we want to support your local bookstore if you're in Santa Cruz.
Right.
Go to Bookshop Santa Cruz or Two Birds Books. And also, Doriad will be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on April 2nd, reading with Lee Herrick, the Poet Laureate of California. So thank you for joining me, Doriad.
Thank you for asking me, Dion.
I'm so thrilled to be talking to you about this beautiful book today. But before we get into the book, I want to ask you the most important question of all. How is your bunny?
Oh, that's what I was doing right before this. We're making the bunny's cage smaller because she's a house bunny now and she doesn't really spend that much time in her cage. And so we're making it smaller so we can get to the pantry. I know this bunny has taken over our lives. It's every space is a bunny space. You know,
every space is a bunny space. So what has having a bunny brought to your life?
Joy.
Joy.
You know, just so much joy. Every day we're happy to wake up and go down and see how she is. And she's so delightful, you know, and she's not the pet for everyone. She's not a cat. She's not a dog. She doesn't come on command. She doesn't want to be picked up. You know, she's her own bunny. And she's the one who decides whether or not she's going to come to you or she's going to, you know. And she loves licking Joe's ankles, though.
Well, and I respect all that.
Yeah. And she sits by him like a dog, like she's just protecting him. She's always got one foot on his foot.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's a foot thing. Yep. You know, rabbits can be pretty ferocious. We used to raise rabbits on the ranch as a kid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I saw the mother rabbit chasing a cat across the street the other, you know, and the cat's like, you know, I mean, she's like, get the fuck out of my territory, cat. Sorry. Oh, radio. Very sorry, radio.
So there's going to be a little bleep in there. How'd you find this bunny?
The bunny found us. The mom and dad were dropped off on Easter in our neighborhood. And the mom and dad decided to adopt us. And they would come to our, and we would feed them. And the mother was a rabbit, brown rabbit. And the dad was a Hottot, which is a little French rabbit that's white with a black eye.
Like a Hottentot. It's like a Hottentot.
Yeah. And we figured they were fixed because they looked like house bunnies. But they weren't. And I looked down into this little burrow she had dug one day and saw two little heads pop out and went, oh, my God. And one was white and one was gray. And so I thought, great, you know, she's got her baby bunnies. And then I came out the next day and the white one was gone. And I thought, ooh, the feral cats or a skunk or something got her. So I took the gray one in and put it in a box, read up on bunny behavior, And the mom only comes and feeds the bunny twice a day, once at dawn and once at dusk. And then she leaves the nest. She doesn't want to attract predators, so she goes away. And so she fed the bunny every day. I'd get up, I'd go take her out, her mom would feed her, I'd take her back in. And this went on for 4 weeks until the mother decided she was done feeding that baby. And so by then she'd been eating solid food. So we just took her in the house, put her in a cage, and gave her a lot of kale.
Okay.
And yeah, kale, lettuce, any green leaf vegetable, beans, you know, she loves fruit, apples, bananas. She goes, bananas are bunny catnip. You know, all you have to do is cut open a banana and she smells it and runs over. But, you know, so then we just raised her. So she's really known no one but us. You know, she probably has dim memory of her parents.
Wow, I can tell you're really into the buddy.
We love that bunny so much. Joe keeps saying, I didn't know it was possible to love something this much.
Oh God.
I know.
Oh God. Well, let's jump into your poems because,
Okay.
growing up on a ranch, I could talk animal husbandry all day. I've got lots of rabbit poems.
Right.
Rabbit memories. I actually have some rabbit poems too,
Well,
but
we'll talk later.
we'll talk later. All right, let's jump into your first poem that I want to talk about, which is called Singer, on page 21 in
Got it.
early in the book. Do you want to just jump right in, or do you have something you want to say
Sure.
about the poem? Okay,
Yeah.
great.
I
All right.
mean, my selected had 20 new poems about my mother. And I thought, good, I'm done with those, you know. And then I just kept writing poems about my mother, which I've always written poems about my mother. She's my muse. And so this is one in the book. And anyone of a certain age knows what a Singer sewing machine is. We all have them in our living rooms, little factories that we, you know, created clothing from. And this is called Singer for my mom. If I could go back to the living room window of my childhood house, look again through the pane, it would be a telescope lens through which I might see the first woman I ever met, my mother, at her sewing machine, rewinding the bobbin, little spool with holes like an old movie reel, our tiny lives spun inside of. I might see her long piano fingers touch the balance wheel, the throat plate, the presser bar, one bare foot working the treadle, her heel revealing only the first three letters in black latticed metal, sin. My mother was what some called a sinful woman, divorced, pregnant without a husband, a baby boy given up for adoption, remarried. Another baby born of another man, a one-night stand while her husband was away at war. She drank too much, thought too much, laughed with her head thrown back, danced with anyone. Too pretty, too brainy, too tall, her black hair a snare that hooked men in. But right now, she's fully visible, stretching the fabric for a kitchen curtain. A child's dress, swatches she salvaged from the deep sale bins, using the selvage for a hem, thereby cutting her handiwork by half. The black oiled mechanism banging out dress after dress, tablecloths and runners, nothing she couldn't cobble together from the waste of others. She was a very particular, peculiar mother, and by now you can see why we loved her. She was a lit fuse in the rain. She turned from her work and set those same fingers on the piano keys and pulled music through the air. Making something from nothing was what she was good at. Love, children, pants and skirts to dress them in, a table covered with cherries on which the beautiful food appeared, roses from her front yard garden in an old cracked vase. Her long arms around our shoulders, saying, sit still, eat, try not to spill anything.
That was Dorianne Locks reading from her new book, Life on Earth, from Norton and Company. This is KSQD Santa Cruz and KSQT Prunedale 89.7. This is Deanna Riley. This is the High Poetry Collective. You know, on this reading, I really love that ending, try not to spill anything. And I think I love it because you know things are going to get spilled. And we know that she has spilled a lot, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just that's just a fabulous way to end. Try not to spill.
Yeah, I think there was another line. And I think Sharon Old said, just cut it off at the little, you know, three little lines and reverse. I think I had sit still, try not to spill anything, eat. Right. Or something like that. And she said, no, end it with try not to spill anything. That's the brilliance of Sharon Olds.
Because it's got more duende in it.
It does. Yeah.
It's got, well, by duende, I mean a little bit of darkness.
It's try. I know you're not going to succeed. I didn't succeed, but try anyway.
Yeah. I love the complexity of this woman. I mean, the sin on the sewing machine, the letters are rubbed away and only the word sin remains as a metaphor that's really powerful. And that sin, I just love how a word can take you into an idea. Mm-hmm. And then we hear that it makes a great turn. We hear that my mother was what some called a sinful woman. And then the list: divorced, pregnant, without a husband, a baby boy given up for adoption, remarried, another baby, born of another man, a one-night stand while her husband was away at war. What a powerful list.
Yeah.
That is.
All true.
Yeah, so we don't need to say the mother of the speaker. We can. It's one of those instances where the truth is interesting enough just by itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the reason I write these poems about my mother is I wish everybody had had a mother like my mother. Even though she was a terribly flawed human being, she was also brilliant, funny, beautiful, stately. She was like, you know, Katharine Hepburn, or, you know, I mean, she walked into a room and people just looked at her, you know, and she was a great, 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 great mother, but she also was a terrible mother in so many ways. But to try to capture that complexity of her, and I just want people to know her. I feel like I can't believe the whole world doesn't know my mother, you know.
She was bigger than life.
Yeah, larger than
it was a lit fuse in the rain.
Yeah.
Was it difficult? This is kind of personal, but was it difficult to come to terms with that? With someone being so flawed and who probably did a lot of harm, but also was just so full of spirit and life and beauty?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, I had a horrible father, so I didn't have a choice. I had to have some parent, you know. And luckily, she was a great parent. And I loved her, and it made up for the fact that I had this horrible father. And because she was my only buoy, you know, my therapist would say, well, yeah, that's all fine and good about your father. That's obvious. But what about your mother? And I go, no, my mother was great. You know, I mean, she's the one who saved me. She went, well, you know, there might be an issue or two here that we might talk about, you know. It was so hard for me to see her flaws when I was growing up because I couldn't afford to. I had to see her as a savior. I had to see her as perfect.
Were you ever able to kind of look into those flaws?
Oh, yeah. You know, and that's what a lot of these poems are about. She's mm-hmm. a very flawed human being, you know.
I think one of the things that's really remarkable about your writing is that you were one of the people early on that wrote about child abuse and child trauma. Was that difficult to do? Because there weren't as many people doing it when you started doing it.
Right. The poems weren't difficult to write. I had to write them, you know. It was, revealing them, you know. And I would reveal them only to my friends or, you know, whatever. And they would encourage me. And I was very resistant. But eventually I started taking them to workshops and, you know, and eventually publishing them. But it wouldn't have been something I probably would have done if I hadn't had encouragement from people who loved me and thought they were worthy, you know, and useful out in the world.
I'm really interested in the private and the public as a poet, because I think that most writers, poets, they're driven to write, but there's this question about making their poems public. And, you know, there's a lot of ego involved in that. And how do you grapple with your ego? So I really liked your epigraph in the book, the Mary Ruffel quote. I began writing because I had made friends with the dead. They had written to me in their books about life on earth, and I want to write back and say, yes, house, bridge, river, hair, no, maybe, never, forever. And I feel like she's really grappling with why write, why put it out there? Why did you pick this epigraph? And do you have any thoughts about how to manage feeling okay about putting your poems out in the world? Not just because it's hard, because it's private and it's mortifying, but also because there's just so much ego around that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was too frightened by it to have much ego about it. I wasn't going, oh, gee, you know, these poems are going to make me beloved by all. I mean, they weren't going to make me, you know, and they were going to reveal something terrible about me, you know, that I thought was terrible and that people could use against me or, you know, whatever. And so my ego is pretty subsumed by my fear and anxiety. And, but as time went on, you know, I mean, it's a great decider, you know, I mean, time eventually decided that it was okay. And in fact, I would, you know, I garnered a certain amount of attention, and it was good attention, you know, for the poems. So that kept giving me courage to keep going with it, you know. But I said, like I said, if I left to my own devices, I probably wouldn't have published them for all those reasons. And so I feel I've had enough letters and comments from people to know that it has helped other people to talk about those things out loud.
Yeah, that was really true for me. I mean, you just talked about things like, I don't know, dirty underwear, you know, some like, oh, you can write about dirty underwear. You can describe dirty. It's like, you just gave me permission. If you can write about that, you can write about anything.
Yeah. Well, I had Sharon Olds as a great teacher in that. She also, you know, was unafraid to, or maybe she was less afraid than me, yeah. But, you know, she paved the way if we hadn't had her, and really Anne Sexton before her. And, you know, I mean, there are many antecedents to what it is we do. It's just that it's in another language and another time and, you know. So
and it's a minority of women for so long. Muriel Rukeyser, was another one. Well, let's go ahead and read Honeymoon, which is on page 26 in your book.
On a different note. And this was written for my dear husband, who's in ministering to the bunny right now. And it's called Honeymoon. We didn't have one, unless you count Paris, 20 years later, after we'd almost given up on the idea. We'd imagined one, long nights beneath a warm celestial sky, you growing your beard, me in a silk turquoise robe, floating, billowing on a deserted beach, foraging for whole sand dollars, jellyfish washed up on the shore, their glittering insides visible, still pulsing through flesh made of glass. But it never happened. We had to work through our vacations, refinance the house, find someone to cut down the cedar that threatened to bury us with each storm. We wanted to make up for the wedding, or lack of one, the granite courthouse steps, the small room with the desk, the flimsy document stamped with a cheap gold seal. Even then, we were meant to have a party on the deck, cheese and crackers, fruit plates, sparkling grape cider and plastic cups, our friends on the lawn calling you the big kahuna, me, Mrs. Dynamite, me calling you my sweet dragon, you calling me your little red Corvette. Instead, Time found a way to demand each minute, until one night, after you'd gotten a small windfall in the mail, you turned to me and said, "I'm going to take you to Paris." Me, in my ratty robe and floppy slippers, you, in your flannel PJ bottoms and black wife beater, muting the clicker when I said, "What?" and saying it again. Then we were there, in our 60s, standing below the dire Eiffel Tower, its 81 stories of staircases we couldn't possibly climb, its 73,000 tons of puddled iron. You taking my picture for posterity, kissing you beneath the pathway of arched trees, our voices echoing against the 6 million skulls embedded in the stone catacombs. Me saying, "I guess you weren't kidding." You taking my hand in the rain.
That was Dorianne Locks reading Honeymoon from Life on Earth.
And kind of breaking down at the end there.
We're laughing because she's crying. Let me just say, this is KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, and KSQD Prunedale, 89.7, and online at ksqd.org. And Dorianne is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on April 2nd. So check out our website at hivepoetry.org. Go to the events page to get all the deets. This is a very touching poem. I feel like it is the companion piece to Dark Harvest.
Oh, nice. Yeah. It is. I didn't think of that, but that's true. Joe's poem, Dark Harvest, from the title poem from his book.
Yeah, which is likewise a beautiful poem. I actually think like a little chapbook of love poems would be really sweet.
We should do that.
Once again, a killer line at the ends. Me saying, "I guess you weren't kidding," you taking my hand in the rain. And once again, I think it's a powerful image because there's a lot of rain, metaphorical rain in this poem. I mean, the difficulties, but you're taking each other's hand in those difficulties. So I just, once again, that final line seems to sum up the marriage.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. This is one of those poems. We often play Ruth Stone's poetry game, which is where you throw a bunch of words at each other and a phrase and a color. And this is one of those poems. And many of the words came from the sushi menu we had at home. And it had things like Big Kahuna, Mrs. Dynamite, Sweet Dragon, Little Red Corvette. Those were the names of the sushi offerings.
I thought it was real because I know he calls people hot rod all the time.
Joe is he's the champ of nicknames, you know, for everyone. And then I had to use words like celestial and jellyfish and, you know, granite and, you know, whatever. Those were some of the words. And then we had to use the phrase, "I guess you weren't kidding." And I wasn't able to get it in until the very last line, you know, but I got it in.
Yeah, it's in an important place in the poem, the penultimate line. Yeah. So I know you really like working with word lists, and so do I, and I have some reasons why I like them. Why do you love word lists so much, other than you get great results like this?
Well, because you use words you wouldn't usually use, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you wouldn't, it's not in your particular vocabulary to use those words, but when you're forced to use them, they often get used in very interesting ways, you know, because you're thinking, "Oh, I'm trying to say this, but I've got to get this word in." So you just attach it to something, you know, almost randomly, you know, it's just like, "Oh, this word will fit." But also you're distracting your conscious mind. Your conscious mind wants to write this really sappy, sentimental love poem to your husband. But your unconscious mind says, "Oh no, there's a whole lot more going on in here that you're unaware of, you know. And now that you're distracted, I'm going to come in here and say these things that are going to surprise you."
Which is what we love about poetry.
Yeah. And you have to be surprised or it's not a poem. And so I love those lists. I'm grateful to them. I use them almost every single time I write. Once in a while, I just a poem comes out, you know, but a lot of the time I'm using these words. Probably almost every poem in this book came from a workshop that we do once a week on Mondays with Matthew Dickman, Major Jackson, his wife Dee Dee Jackson, Sharon Olds, Joe, and me.
Oh,
We
what a
all, maybe, and sometimes Mike McGriff, but we all get together. We throw out a bunch of words. I usually give the phrase. Joe gives the time limit. We go away for whatever and write and come back and read our poems.
You do that every Monday, huh?
Every Monday.
Wow.
This whole book came from the Monday poetry, you know, group that we
You
have.
have a couple of books that you wrote when you were my mentor.
Yes.
Yeah, so I want credit.
And I'm sure many of them came from exercises I gave you that I did.
Probably, yes, I think so, exactly. Like writing about being burned.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It got you a really important poem.
It
Yeah.
did. Yeah, got it on the slowdown, and then
Yeah.
you put a poem in here about being burned too. I really love how you're not afraid to make yourself look less than glamorous. I particularly love this description. Let's see. Instead, time found a way to demand each minute until one night, after you'd gotten a small windfall in the mail, you turned to me and said, "I'm going to take you to Paris." Me in my ratty robe and floppy slippers, you in your flannel PJ bottoms and black wife beater, muting the clicker when I said, "What?" and saying it again. Like it's just sort of like this all in the family moment, you know?
Yeah. And Joe, Carol, what's his name? Archie Bunker.
Yeah, so
Well,
yeah, go
yeah,
ahead.
you know, and it's true that we did want to get married, you know, but he had had a heart attack and he didn't have any insurance. So we had to get married quickly so that my insurance at U of O would cover his hospital stay. And so we just went to a courthouse and got married, but we kept saying, but we'll have a real wedding at some point, or we'll have at least a big party, or, you know, I mean, it's all completely true. And, but it just never happened. And we keep saying, oh, one of these days we're gonna, but we're 70 now, so.
But you give yourself a party in this poem in a way. I love the
I
way
do, yeah.
poems imagine other worlds. Even when we meant to have a party on the deck, cheese and crackers, fruit plates, sparkling grape cider in plastic cups, our friends on the lawn calling you the big kahuna or Mrs. Dynamite, me calling you my sweet dragon, you calling me your little red Corvette. So you create this such an intimate scene using sushi names.
If people only knew what was behind our poems.
Yeah, I just love the beauty of two people enjoying beauty together. You know, I think that's so much a part of relationships.
Yeah.
It's just like having another set of eyes next to yours looking at beauty. And you're really one, you never just put something out in a poem. You always dive in and describe it a little bit more. We'd imagine one long nights beneath a warm celestial sky, you growing your beard, me in a sweet silk turquoise robe, floating, billowing on a deserted beach, foraging for whole sand dollars, jellyfish washed up on the shore, their glittering insides visible, still pulsing through flesh made of glass. But it never happened. Yeah, so I just love how you always just go deep into description. And I
Well,
love how.
you know, I learned that from C.K. Williams. Read a lot of C.K. Williams.
I love C.K.
He
Williams.
does the same thing. I learned how to push a sentence forward and end, you know, with the opening of the set, you know, to encase or encapsulate all this other material. And he was a king at doing that. You know, her lipstick was red, not the red of fire hydrants or stoplights, but the red of the, you know, ocean when the sun, I mean, and he just keep going, you know, and I think you can't do that, CK, but he could.
Yeah, people don't read him that much anymore.
No.
His sentences are like they're trying to escape from the page.
Yeah.
He's it's like the page can't contain him. And I love this way he writes about people and the compassion he has for people. So C.K. Williams, people out there, yes. Check him out. So let's move on to another poem. Mm-mm-mm.
Another Year on Earth.
Another Year on Earth on page 32.
Okay. And this is kind of a companion poem to Life on Earth. Another year on Earth, another butt in the ashtray, another ordinary night. But this time I unbolt the door and walk out under it. The moon's breast full and milky, her light chiseling the new crop of sunflowers, their crisp yellow collars turned earthward, their seedy eyes closed while the bees sleep. I lean against a tree, fix my eyes on one bright star, maybe Venus, goddess of love and beauty, one of her days longer than a year. She's aging so gracefully, 4,503 billion years old, and she doesn't look a day over an eon. Maybe it's because she has no moons to tie her down, like Jupiter and Saturn, who look haggard and careworn. Jupiter with deep stretch marks and crow's feet, Saturn surrounded by the wreckage of her life. But Venus floats alone in her tabernacle of space, watching TV while she lifts weights like a pro on her living room floor, her red beauty mark enhancing her still kissable lips. Once somebody said, "I dare you," and I did. Jumped off the bluff into deep seawater. I was a teenager, dumb as they come. And when the undertow pulled me under and spit me up against the rocks, I was sure I had completed my last spectacular act on Earth. But the boys dove in and hauled me out so I could get as old as I am now, almost 70, staring up at Venus in my backyard, wearing nothing but a thin nightgown. The warm summer air lifting it up like Marilyn Monroe's skirt, revealing my pocked and lunar thighs.
That was Dorianne Locks reading from her new book, Life on Earth. I'm Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective, where we not only do podcasts and radio shows, but we also bring in fabulous readers to read at Bookshop Santa Cruz quite frequently, about every other month. And you can find out all about it on our webpage, hivepoetry.org. Go to our events page. And Dorianne is going to be there on April 2nd. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale, 89.7. Once again, a great closing image, revealing my pocked and lunar thighs. And this connection is made between celestial bodies and bodies all throughout this poem, because we're stardust.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. Maybe they're lying. I see you a lot outside staring at space and getting information from space.
Mm-hmm.
Facts about
the poet Frank Gaspar, who writes a lot about looking up at the stars. And I just love, again, his poems so much that I think they really influenced me in that way. But I think all of us, as we age, begin to look up at the stars in a new way, you know.
And the moon has always been a poet's, an object of...
Well, also the poet's cliche, you know. And so I'm like Lee Young Lee, you know, who said, If I'd realized when I was writing Rose that that's a cliche for love, you know, I never would have written those poems. And of course, we couldn't live without those poems. You know, they're beautiful and they defy the cliche. And I think in some ways I wanted to defy the cliche of the moon. And you know, her symbolism and her feminine aspects and all those things that have already been written about 10,000 times, you know. But I want to write about it too.
We're talking about Facts About the Moon, which is one of a really famous poem of yours. And
well, that's relative. As Philip says, I'm known by literally dozens of people.
Famous to me. But yeah, so Facts About the Moon is a good one to check out because the moon becomes a woman sitting outside her son's hospital room. Mm-hmm. And her eyes are craters. Like, that is just so, that gets tattooed into your brain, that grieving mother looking up with her eyes like craters. So, yeah, Dorianne, you write really well about things that are hard to get away with writing about. It's like trying to write about grass after Whitman.
I know. And yet, you know, if you're Mark Doty, you can do it.
I want to ask you about some of the other activities you do. Like, you judge a lot of contests and I'm not going to talk to you about anything. Staying with the poetry. Like, okay. I'm not going to ask you about all your activities. Don't worry.
Stay clean here. Okay.
I'm going to keep it radio friendly. So you judge a lot of contests. And so you read a lot of other people's poems. Is there anything that, in general, you feel like really blows your head off? What do you think really makes a poem work where you just go, ah, here it is, this is the one? And do you know immediately, you just go, ah, this is it?
Well, yeah, you know, especially when you're reading a group of poems and one just stands up and says, listen to me, mm-hmm. right? You know, it says, I'm confident, you know, I know something about language. I know something about structure. I know something about human relationships. I know something about the world. You know, I'm always looking for a poem that knows itself, you know, that reveals itself in some important way. And sometimes, you know, a poem is just beautiful for its language. You know, but if it doesn't have that other something that we all are looking for in poems, you know, that moment of, ah, that's right. I knew that, but I didn't know that. I didn't know it that way.
It reveals something. It reveals something. Just like you were saying, how when you have a word list, it helps you reveal something in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. So if as a reader, I'm woken up in some way. Stupor of having read, you know, 20 poems by now, and then one says, oh, listen, I've got something to say, you know, and that's hard to define because so many things can do that, so many different kinds of things can do that. But when all those things combine, or many of those things combine in a poem, you're really struck, and then that goes in the pile of, yeah, that one's definitely there.
Yeah, that's why poetry is, I wouldn't say difficult to write, but there's just so many moving pieces. It's such a moving target.
Yeah.
There's so many ways that a poem can work. But that revealing something, that insight seems to be a consistent attribute that we really admire. And sometimes you just feel like you're going through the world and you have all these expectations and all these ideas about what you're seeing when we know that we don't know hardly anything. I mean, we think we know everything, but, you know, we can't stop wars. You know, we can't see all the things that a dog sees or smells. I mean, we're so limited in what we can see. And then poetry just rips away a little piece of the veil. And all of a sudden you're plunged into a different place. I mean, that's what I love about poetry.
Yeah, we're habitual creatures. And so we get used to the fact that flowers grow out of the ground, you know, and that the moon comes back every cycle, and that, you know, we just forget. And so poets really are here to help you remember and be startled again that we're alive. You know, we're in this world that we have no idea how it works, you know? I mean, it's rolling around in space and we're somehow on it, you know?
It's kind of resurrection. All of a sudden you kind of wake up and
wake up. And that, I mean, my first book was called Awake, you know, wake up and see what's around you. And you can't do it for very long, or you couldn't work your job. You couldn't take care of kids. You couldn't, you know, right. But once in a while, you need that in order to, like you say, resurrect your life and resurrect your place here in the universe, and your wonder and your awe, you know, and your joy and your tragic, you know, life, mm-hmm. you know, how tragic it is, but also how there are these just dumbstruck moments of joy that make up for all the tragedy in a moment, you know,
and miracles.
And that we're all the same, you know, it's just ordinary miracles.
I mean, that's something about this book that I really noticed is how there's an optimism to it. It feels essentially optimistic and existential. There's plenty of suffering. There's plenty of darkness and duende. And some of this was written in the pandemic, but it's a reflection of a very deep acceptance of life with all its deficiencies.
Yeah.
I feel if I were going to write a blurb, that's probably, maybe I'll go to Goodreads and just,
yeah,
I'll do that. Okay. Let's see. I could have said more about that other one, but we want to read as many poems as we can. I'll just read a little bit of this Another Year on Earth again. I lean against a tree, fix my eyes on one bright star, maybe Venus, goddess of love and beauty. One of her days longer than a year. She's aging so gracefully. I'm glad somebody is. 4,503 billion years, and she doesn't look a day over an eon. Okay. I love this one. Mugged by poetry.
Yeah, there are these moments of humor in the poem. I mean, my favorite line in the whole book is the first woman I ever met.
Oh, I love that. Talking about your mother. Yeah, I underlined that. You know, when I read that that was in Singer, right? That's in Singer. You're talking about your mother and you describe her as the first woman you ever met. I stopped for a minute and went, oh, yeah.
That's right.
Your mother, well, maybe there's a nurse in the room.
Right.
She's got to be one of the first people you really like paid attention to.
Yeah, right. You know, and, you know, she really is the first person all of us met, you know, and she's a very important person in everybody's life, whether you actually had one or not.
Yeah.
Right. You know, everyone needs a mother. If you don't have one, you'll find one. Like our bunny.
Well, I think that line, the first woman I ever met, I mean, it's sort of an example of how poetry makes you see your life differently.
Yeah.
And see the little miracle in that. It really makes you stop and go, everyone is born from a mother. Everyone. I mean, you meet her when you're in the womb, really. You meet her from the inside out.
Right.
And for now, that's not changing.
And, you know, I mean, I came to that really. I discovered that. I suddenly went, God, that's right. You know, she's the first woman I ever met. My God. And, but I cracked myself up I laughed out loud when I wrote that line, you know. So there's that wonderful surprise, that, you know, miracle of recognition. Like, wow. You know, I wish my mom had been alive to tell her that. Mom, guess what?
Well, and it's kind of shows you the kinds of things that can surprise you.
Yeah.
You know, that they could just come from the oddest places, but truly something you knew, but you didn't think you knew.
Right.
So anyway, I mean, speaking of funny, you have an epigraph by Tony Hoagland on this Mugged by Poetry on page 44. You want to go ahead and read that one?
Yeah, the poem is written for Tony Hoagland, who sent me a handmade chapbook made from old postcards called Oh My God Poetry, with a whale breaching off the coast of New Jersey and seven of his favorite poems by various authors typed up, taped on, and tied together with a broken shoelace, which I actually have in my office right now. which I will show you, Dion.
Okay, pick it up and show it to me. Yeah, that epigram kind of broke my heart. Yeah. Oh my God, look at that. Oh my God, poetry. That's a killer whale.
Yeah.
Orcas whale.
And all these poems inside put on postcards. But anyway, he did stuff like that, you know. And he was just such a delightful human being and a wonderful poet and a wonderful critic. But this is called Mugged by Poetry. Reading a good one can make me love the one who wrote it, as well as the animal or element or planet or person the poet wrote it for. I end up as I always do, flat on my back like a drunk in the grass, loving the world. Like right now, I'm reading a poem called Summer by John Ashbery, whose poems I never much cared for. And suddenly, in the dead of winter, there is a sound like the wind forgetting in the branches that means something nobody can translate. I fall in love with that line, can actually hear it. Not the line, but the wind. And it's summer again, and I forget I don't like John Ashbery poems. So I light a cigarette and read another by Zbigniew Herbert, a poet I've always admired but haven't read enough of, called To Marcus Aurelius, that begins, "Good night, Marcus, put out the light and shut the book, for overhead is raised a gold alarm of stars." First of all, I suddenly love anyone with the name Zbigniew. Second of all, I love anyone who speaks in all sincerity to the dead, and by doing so, brings that personage back to life, plunging a hand through the past to flip on the light. The astral physics of it just floors me. Third of all is that gold alarm of stars. By now, I'm a goner. And even though I have to get up tomorrow at 6 a.m., I forge ahead and read God's Justice by Anne Carson, another whose poems I'm not overly fond of, but don't actively disdain. I keep reading one line over and over, hovering above it like a speckled starling, spying on the dragonfly with turquoise dots all down its back, like Lauren Bacall. Like Lauren Bacall. Well, hell, I could do this all night. I could be in love like this for the rest of my life, with everything in the expanding universe and whatever else might be beyond it that we can't grind a lens big enough to see. I light up another smoke, maybe the one that will kill me, and go outside to listen to the moon scalding the ice trees. What, I ask you, will become of me?
Once again,
they're all poems that I had said, I mean, all poems by poets I'd said I didn't like.
Oh,
so he gathered all the poems he did love from those poets and sent them to me.
Oh my God. I love that. I love it when people change my mind like that.
Right.
I mean, and it's so much a part of this journey of being a reader and a poet is just keep trying to like stuff. As Danusha Lamaris calls it, being a liker. And reading to like poems, reading to look for what really works for you. You know, what helps me do that is having a pen in my hand and underlining. And even if I don't get the whole poem, I underline parts of it. And I go, well, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, this I get. So that once again was Dorianne Locke's Reading Life on Earth, her new book, available now from Norton or everywhere you get your books. Go to your local bookstore. And once again, she's going to be reading at Bookshop Santa Cruz on April 2nd with the California Poet Laureate Lee Herrick. I'm Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective at KSQU Santa Cruz, 9.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale, 89.7, online at ksqd.org. I love this line. Oh, I love that you can pronounce that guy's name.
I had to look it up, you know.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Second of all, I love anyone who speaks in all sincerity to the dead. I like that. And by doing so, brings that personage, I like the word personage, back to life, plunging a hand through the past to flip on the light. The astrophysics of it just floors me. And you know, that's something about poetry that really interests me, is I feel like it, that what light is to visual art, time is to poetry.
Thank you. That's great. Yeah.
The way you can play in the memory field. Mm-hmm. You can do it with your own life. You can do it with history. Mm-hmm. Linear time disappears in poetry.
Absolutely. My friend Tyree Day, who works at Pacific University with me now, just gave a talk about that, how you can go into a poem and defy time. You know, the Sharon Olds poem, when she goes back and looks at her father sleeping and says, I can have him now like this, and I can change. I can walk up to that little 12-year-old girl and tell her she's going to survive, you know.
Yeah, and she goes back in time to when her parents create her.
Right, to the moment of creation.
She turns them into paper dolls and puts them together, and they spark or something. Yeah. She's amazing at that, like just going back in time and rewriting it, or just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what you do with time in a poem. But it's so magical. Yeah. So I love the way you just talk about that there. The astral physics of it just floors me. And I love this ending too. I light up another smoke, maybe the one that will kill me. Oh my God. That's some, you know, once again, you're not afraid to make yourself look, you know, I don't want to say bad, but you're like, this is me with all my warts, you know, this is what I do. I light up another smoke, maybe the one that will kill me, and go outside to listen to the moon scalding the iced trees. Scalding the iced trees. I love that. But actually, let's see what I loved. Poetry sees what can't be seen. I could be in love like this for the rest of my life with everything in the expanding universe and whatever else might be beyond it that we can't grind a lens big enough to see. Yeah, poetry can see what can't be seen in other ways, which that's, yeah, we keep coming back to that in this discussion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mugged by poetry. So you do teach. What do you think is one of the most important things you try to get across to your students?
Well, I, you know, basically the undercurrent of another part of this talk has been about all the writers that I read. And the first thing I do is give them a list from 1920s down, telling them all the important poets that lived and died, and then all of the contemporary poets that followed them. And so that they can see the influence of those poets on their generation, kind of. And I just give them all the books I love to read, you know. And so I encourage them to read good poetry. I mean, it's the only way you can learn to write good poetry, is if you read enough of it and you see how many ways there are in to a poem, how many ways there are to get out of a poem. You know, how many different structures and movements, you know, you can make in a poem. You can only learn that by reading good poetry. You can read all the critical books you want, and it won't tell you. You just have to experience it. You have to experience that shock of recognition to learn how to create a shock of recognition in yourself so that you can transmit it to your reader. You know, and if you can learn that, you can write poems. But it's a hard thing to learn, you know, and you have to do it the way you're doing it, by tearing a poem apart and saying, oh, I see now how this goes with this, and how this poet uses an image and keeps reconstituting it, or breaking it down, or finding aspects of it that are metaphorical and that somehow lead back to my theme or my subject or my philosophical or emotional state, or, you know. And that's a, like you say, it's like juggling. How many balls can I keep in the air here? You have to learn how to do that. And a lot of it is technical, and a lot of it is that instinct In other words, getting rid of your conscious mind, because it doesn't know crap. It only knows what you've received, you
Yeah,
know.
your conditioning. It knows your historical conditioning, your cultural conditioning, and
Your emotional conditioning, all of that. You need to let your unconscious mind unravel itself before you. You know, it's like wakeful dreaming, or, you know, and you can't be afraid to look at your dream head on and say, yeah, everyone in that dream is me, you know.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you have to use all levels of cognition, really. I mean, you use analysis, you're using synthesis, you're putting things together, and you're using evaluation to just look at it and see what you like. A lot of it comes from enjoyment. Just enjoy poetry too.
If it wasn't fun, I wouldn't do it. I mean, that was the reason I started doing it, because it was fun. It was fun to rhyme words. It was fun to, you know, work in little forms. It was fun to, you know, say things you shouldn't say in polite conversation. It was fun to, you know, shock. It was fun to, right? You know, look at something for a long time. I mean, it was just fun. It was just a kid playing in sandbox, putting stuff together and making a little world.
Joy.
And it became a job, you
Joy
know.
and enthusiasm.
Yeah, you
Yeah,
know.
you've got a lot, you still got a lot of food enthusiasm for it, clearly. Poetry and bunnies.
Yeah.
Why don't we just read I Never Want to Die, and then we'll probably be done.
Yeah, wrap up.
Yep.
Okay. I did never want to die. That's a true statement. I never wanted to die. It's the best part of the day. Morning lights sliding down rooftops, treetops, the birds pulling themselves up out of whatever stupor darkened their wings, night still in their throats. I never wanted to die, even when those I loved died around me, away from me, beyond me. My life was never in question, if for no other reason than I wanted to wake up and see what happened next. I continue to want to open like that, like the flowers who lift their heavy heads as the hills outside the window flare gold for a moment before they turn on their sides and bare their creased backs. Even the cut flowers in a jar of water lift their soon to be dead heads and open their eyes. Even they want a few more sips to dwell here in paradise a few days longer.
Dorianne, thank you for coming into the hive so much. Thank you for talking to me. I so enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was, oh my goodness. Okay, this is Deanna Riley. This is the Hive Poetry Collective. We've been talking to Dorianne Locks, her new book, Life on Earth, and she's coming April 2nd to Bookshop Santa Cruz. Go to our website, hivepoetry.org, and check it out. Buy a book there or buy it anywhere you get your books. This is KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM, KSQT Prunedale 89.7. Thank you for tuning in, and thank you, Dorianne.
Thank you.